It's interesting to see how many people have turned up to hear a fairly dry topic about infrastructure and pricing, but it has been in the news lately. And I thought I'd talk a little bit about managing demand, and it was interesting to see Tim Fisher sort of stole much of my thunder with his articles in the paper previously. I just want to use this opportunity to perhaps give some background and some perspectives. These perspectives largely come from our work we've been doing with Manchester in designing the scheme they're putting forward for funding from the UK government, and also the work we've been doing in Singapore where they're reviewing their land transport policies. So I guess the overarching theme of this is, do we want to manage congestion or continue to build to cope with congestion? Because I think there's growing concern that, you know, we can't completely build our way of some of these congestion problems we have with our transport system. So there's sort of five things I just wanted to run through very quickly, and I'm aware I've got a very strict time frame, so I may rush through these. I'm not sure what's happening with the buttons. I just want to give a context and give you a snapshot of what's happening around the world with congestion pricing at the moment. I then just want to look at the fundamental cases underpinning of why cities around the world are looking at these congestion management schemes. I thought it was interesting to look at where tolling fits in. Australia is one of the world's leading countries where we're using tolling to fund road infrastructure. So how does tolling fit in with this pricing regime? Given that we've got to acknowledge there's a lot of barriers to even sort of talking about congestion management schemes in Australia, you know, explore what some of the barriers are and perhaps give you my thoughts about, you know, what we should be doing to take this issue forward, if in fact you agree with me that it should go forward. Perhaps you don't. So in terms of the context, we see the Rudd government has been elected, and very clearly they've put infrastructure on the agenda. If you look at their policies they released before the election, they're very much focusing on supporting spending to expand our infrastructure capacity. You'll be aware that Infrastructure Australia has been announced, and they're going to complete an audit by the end of 2008. But what we're finding with road projects is they're becoming increasingly complex because they're going through developed urban areas. There's extensive use of tolling, and there's growing cost. But the government's, with the growing cost, to build a freeway now is costing about $400 million per kilometre of road, generally because there's extensive tunnelling involved with it. What we're finding is it's actually hard to start justifying some of those projects because the costs are now starting to exceed the benefits. And so we've got to start looking at some of the other alternatives. In terms of the international context, it's interesting to look at the cities that have introduced the schemes. You can see Singapore, it's the best known example, in the early 70s, and it was quite a few years before any other city sort of touched it. It was seen to be too difficult, too complex. But you can see now cities are starting to adopt these things almost one a year. There's some real momentum building in the rollout of these schemes. There are schemes being designed now for Cardiff, Edinburgh, Manchester, Copenhagen, Helsinki, Turin. In the USA, San Francisco, Seattle, New York are looking at it. Shanghai is looking at it. So we can see this list continuing to expand as we move ahead. So if we look at the case for pricing, I'm an engineer, as David mentioned, so I'm not an economist, but what I understand about the economics is we get efficient pricing where the marginal cost that the user faces reflects the externalities incurred. And I think it's acknowledged that our current pricing systems doesn't include the externalities. Now, in Auckland, there's been a study done to look at this, and you can see the relative difference between the marginal cost and the charges. And you can actually see the car is only charging sort of a fraction of its externality cost. It's also true of bus and train. And being a public transport planner primarily, one of the arguments we use to justify the subsidies on public transport is the fact the car's not charging it. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because we're not fully pricing for cars, we have to subsidise public transport. It's interesting when we look at the off-peak. In fact, there's an argument we overprice public transport in the off-peak because we typically charge the same price all day. But if we're running a train, it actually costs very little to put an extra passenger on when there's empty seats available, which is the situation you have in the off-peak. If we align pricing, three things as we'd expect to happen. Because we're going to reduce prices on public transport in the off-peak and increase prices a lot more in the peaks will spread. People will start changing their work habits. It'll increase public transport use in the off-peak. If I keep looking this, otherwise it keeps rolling off. And we'll also have a reduced funding requirement because obviously by putting the prices up, we remove a lot of the subsidies and we actually generate a lot of cash. And in fact, a number of cities have introduced congestion pricing schemes as a way of raising revenue to fund their transport infrastructure development. In Norway, they use the money raised to fund road construction. In London, they use money raised to fund public transport improvements. In Singapore, they've been using the money raised to fund both as part of their public transport. And we should also acknowledge that peak period pricing, there's nothing new about that. In fact, if you look at airlines, urban transport, telecommunications, electricity, in fact, it's the norm. And roads is almost unique by not having sort of peak period charges. And in fact, you know, it's sort of common sense that if you've got a problem between supply and demand, you use pricing to control it. So it's interesting to sort of look where some of these other issues come in. Climate change is another reason why we need to start changing the way we consume travel. You know, I don't know if we've got any climate change sceptics here, but they're starting to get hard to find at the moment. A less common issue that's talked about is peak oil, but it's interesting to see Ford announce development of hydrogen technology because they can see the end of oil coming. Queensland's had an inquiry into peak oil and acknowledged it's an issue that should be reflected in our planning. And I mentioned the opportunity for transport funding. It does seem to be one of the problems we have in dealing with some of our infrastructure problems is the lack of funds. So not only is there sort of sound economic reasons to look at the way we adjust pricing, but there's a host of environmental, social and just practical funding reasons why we should be looking at it as well. So the question is, where does tolling currently fit in? Because Australia is actually one of the world's leaders in toll roads. We probably have more privately funded roads, you know, certainly per capita than probably many other places. The primary advantage of tolling is that it actually allows early implementation of the schemes, because if we were allowed to wait for governments to have sufficient funds to fund it, the projects would inevitably not be introduced as soon as we could, and we'd be denied the benefits of those projects. But there are disadvantages of using tolling. As soon as you toll a road, you actually discourage people from using it. And in fact, the whole reason you're building it is to have people use it in the first place. And I guess the best example of that would be the Cross City Tunnel in Sydney, where in fact the benefit of it was to take cars out of the city. But because it was tolled, people were really reluctant to actually use the road and wanted to continue driving through the city. So we actually undermine the reasons we build some of these projects. It's not often evaluated in terms of what the economic impact is, but a few studies have looked at it. And what those studies show is on some of these projects, for each dollar you collect in tolls, you may actually lose 50 cents in economic benefits. So the way we are funding it is not terribly efficient. On some schemes, it can be just an inefficient way of raising revenue because of the cost involved in collecting fairly low-value fares each time can be fairly costly. The technology we have in CityLink has somewhat solved that problem, but in more manually intensive schemes, it becomes a real issue where something like 30-40% of the tolls actually goes in collecting the tolls in the first place. So it's a very inefficient form of raising revenue. And finally, the private ownership can constrain transport system development. You know, the people who have these franchises entered into contracts with government in good faith around the status quo regime. And if that environment is changed, that puts burdens on those operators. And, you know, we need to recognise that. So we start constraining actually what we can do as we roll out these schemes. So there's some advantages and disadvantages with the current regime of tolling. So how am I going for time? It's interesting to think about the barriers, and I think we'd probably all acknowledge one of the key barriers is just actually that we would say it's politics, but in fact, you know, the politicians are our elected representatives, and to be fair, they're probably reflecting the concerns based in the community. So it's... But a number of studies have actually started to look at this question. When we did Melbourne 2030, there was an expectation that there would be extensive increase in public transport, which we recognised would need additional funding. And when we asked the community who were involved in the workshops how they'd like to see that funded, the most popular option was to actually introduce additional road tolls to fund the public transport improvements by quite a considerable margin. Now, the criticism of this is that's a self-selected group. It's the people who turned up at the church halls where we were doing the consultation, so somewhat biased. Sydney actually had a more structured consultation program where they actually telephoned, interviewed a well-structured sample across Sydney, and they also interviewed decision makers. So the decision makers' personal view was about 90% of them felt there should be additional road pricing. They then asked the community what they thought, and in fact they found the community actually was less in favour, and only about 70% of the community was in favour of additional road toll. And the final one is they actually asked the decision makers what they thought the public perception was, and they found the public perception, the decision makers' perception of the public was only 56% would support it. So, in fact, the decision makers seem to be underestimating the public's willingness to accept it. And this is repeated. There's evidence coming out of the UK where they've done similar surveys. We see organisations even like the Australian Automobile Association who are seeing congestion charging as a way of completely restructuring the way we charge people to use the cars on a pay-per-use basis rather than the myriad of charges that go into registration and insurance, which tend to be flat and, for various reasons, inefficient. So, you know, I'd like to probably put forward the view that, in fact, the community might be actually more ready to enter into these discussions than is previously being thought. And I'd probably also... An interesting stat, too, is with when the VCEC looked at this question, something like about 30% of the submissions to VCEC when they floated the idea were actually in favour of going down a path of congestion charging. So, you know, with that background, I guess the question is what would be a way forward? You know, you still may not think it's worth, going down the path, but if we were to go down that path, it seems that governments are sort of following rather than leading on this issue, that the debate's happening outside government because the government's waiting sort of almost for proof that the electorate's ready to accept these ideas. But to sort of help that debate, we need to better understand the winners and losers because, you know, it is obvious that schemes like this will have impacts and you wouldn't want to go down this path without actually carefully considering what those impacts are. So we actually need to understand what the impacts are, who's the winners, who's the losers, who's the beneficiaries of it. And, you know, we've got to sort of think about what the future of our city might look like under a business-as-usual basis or under a congestion charging regime. And it does seem we're spending a lot of money evaluating, you know, the build options. The Rudd government's announced, you know, quite significant hundreds of millions of dollars to look at the planning of new roads, and it seems that at least part of that investment should probably be put into sort of examining better demand management if we're going to more efficiently use the infrastructure we already have. And it strikes me that Auckland's actually ahead of us in this area. Auckland's been developing a congestion charging scheme for Auckland over the last 2 or 3 years, not because they have any commitment to introducing it, but they actually felt they needed to develop a scheme to actually know what they were talking about, and they're using the results of the research they're doing in order to having an informed debate about the issue. And I guess the question is for Australian cities, you know, do we need that sort of information so that we can sort of better consider how we might manage demand?